The next argued case is number 18-1229, Mid-Continent Steel and Wire against the United States. Mr. Gordon, are you going first?
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, good morning. I actually have a preliminary matter to address to the panel, if I may. At 9:30 this morning, I was advised for the first time of some kind of an arrangement between the government and counsel for the defendant appellant, whereby the government was giving them extra time for argument. Until this time, the only indication on the docket of this case had been the negotiated allocation of time that I reached with Mr. Schutz, where I had given him actually more time than us because of the complexity of his issues, so that we had seven minutes of argument for ourselves, and they had eight. Now, I understand an additional 5 minutes has been given without any notice to us, to Mr. Schutz and Mr. Marshak, to argue. So it's highly prejudicial to my client. There's been no indication of this to us until this time. If this is allowed to happen, they will have 13 minutes of argument, and we'll have seven. I prepared for this argument based on the allocation and the agreement I had reached with Mr. Schutz. And until walking in this morning and being informed of this arrangement, we had no indication that this was the case. So I would respectfully ask that that not be allowed.
You're saying the government yielded some of their time?
Yeah, that's where's, my,
that,
that,
where's that extra time supposed to come from?
The government apparently is yielding time to the appellant defendant. I don't know where it's supposed to come from, and I don't know that I understand all the details because, as I mentioned, until 9:30 this morning, I had no indication this was the case. When I went to the clerk's office to inquire, they had no indication, indicated to me they found this very confusing and recommended that I bring it up to the panel. So I apologize for this imposition, but it's very important to us because of the prejudice that could result. We would respectfully ask that this not be permitted.
Now, as far as we know, how much time do you need for your argument?
I have allocated 4 minutes for my affirmative and 3 minutes for rebuttal based on the agreement I had with Mr. Schutz, whereby they had, I think it was 5 minutes and 3 minutes or 4 minutes and 4 minutes.
Let's proceed on that basis. If there are points that need to be pursued, we'll decide what to do about it.
Thank you, Your Honor. Again, may it please the Court, my name is Adam Gordon. I am with the Bristol Group PLLC, appearing today on behalf of Plaintiff Appellant Mid-Continent Steel and Wire Incorporated. Our appeal to the Court raises a factually complex issue of close supplier affiliation arising from an original anti-dumping duty investigation concerning imports of nails from Taiwan. It is a factually rich record, much of which is confidential. So I don't intend to delve deeply into the facts because it would be limited in what we could discuss here.
Tell us what we need to know. Are you saying that this courtroom should not hear what you might say about confidential information, or just that we should be careful in what gets written?
Oh, I think both, Your Honor. I mean, there is a lot of
confidence. I think we need to hear the arguments. If you're saying you're not going to tell us something that helps you, that doesn't help you.
Well, then I will provide all the argument that's necessary today, absolutely, Your Honor. So the record of the underlying investigation shows a relationship between the mandatory respondent and a large number of unaffiliated toll producers. Substantial evidence on the record below demonstrates for a variety of reasons that those toll producers should be deemed affiliated as close suppliers.
That's not enough legally for you to win, is it? The fact that the Commerce might have found in your favor, supported by substantial evidence, doesn't mean that it couldn't find against you, also supported by substantial evidence.
Well, our position, Your Honor, is that the record does only support one outcome, which is that
That's much more than substantial evidence. You need much more than substantial evidence. You need to show that it was downright unreasonable for the Commerce, you know, on these facts to conclude that the kind of control that's at issue in this relevant legal standard is not present.
Well, in fact, Your Honor, I think that raises sort of the crux of the matter, which is what is the standard that should be applied here. The statute and the statement of administrative action are very clear that
ability to control.
It is not correct. It is not actual control. It is the potential to have an impact.
So why I guess the fact that it seemed to me Commerce relied on centrally, let's call it, is
right, I'm sorry.
Centrally, okay. Is that all of these suppliers, had they chosen to, could have found other buyers. And that was enough for Commerce to conclude that they were not dependent on, was it PT here, I guess?
Yes.
And you know, that together with basically, you know, reasonable, consistent year-to-year profit margins, why is that not enough?
It is not enough, Your Honor, because the statute doesn't require that the does not require exclusivity. It does not require that a supplier be not make a profit. Which, in fact, it's
no. But maybe I've mistakenly introduced two facts. I guess I'd like you to talk about just one of those, which is Commerce's finding that there were other importers that were available for these 11 or so, you say allegedly really affiliated, but they said not affiliated, nail makers to that they could have sold to. And as long as they could have sold to them, then there really wasn't an ability of PT to control them. Because if they tried to control, they'd go elsewhere.
Having the potential, in fact, I think what we have to look at is what actually happened in the period investigation, not what is speculatively possible. The facts about what actually happened in the original investigation indicate that in nearly every instance, that potential, even if it was there, was not exercised. The other item I would add to that is it's important to keep in mind the statute talks about a close supplier relationship, not a captive supplier relationship. Commerce's interpretation and administration of the statute here, it requires actual control. And if you look at the factors they list and how they justify reaching a negative determination, they're looking for a captive supplier. Not a closed supplier. You can be a closed supplier. You can have reliance, and you can be subject to influence by virtue of a closed supplier relationship, even if you have the potential ability to do business elsewhere. The question I think that should be asked is, what really happened? And what really happened during the period of investigation? The record shows very clearly that you can talk about the potential to provide your services to other parties, but did that really happen? That's the question that has to be addressed.
As PT was not abusing them, why would they change?
You don't have to abuse a supplier to have a close supplier relationship. That's exactly why Congress amended the statute in 1995. As the Statement of Administrative Action states, it was to allow the department to, and I'm paraphrasing here, to better come to terms with the complexities of modern business relationships that don't have to include an equity ownership relationship to have affiliation. And what we see on the record of this case is exactly this kind of a situation. You don't have to have ownership. You don't have to have complete captive, a completely captive producer to have the ability to impact decisions concerning pricing, production, or cost. And that's exactly what happened on the record below. We think it's important to address both the fact that the Commerce Department's analysis relied on an improper legal standard requiring actual control, but also that the trial court below affirmed on that basis incorrectly. And you can look at a couple of the quotes that we have actually provided in our brief, where Commerce actually talks about affiliation, quote, affiliation through a close supplier relationship under 19 CFR 351102B3 must be evidenced by the relationship's effect on decisions. That's requiring actual control beyond what the statute requires and even what Commerce's own regulations themselves require. Commerce's regulations and the preamble to the regulation are very clear that actual control is not required to support finding of close supplier affiliation. And in this case, we submit that the record supports only one outcome, which is that these suppliers are affiliated with PT through a close supplier relationship. I have 17 seconds left, so I will.
Okay, thank you, and we'll save you rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Schutz.
Yes, good morning.
Are you doing both your responsive argument and your affirmative cross appeal?
So this is where the confusion kind of came in with all this. So I'm just doing our direct and then rebuttal to...
I'm sorry, what do you mean by our direct and not...
I'm sorry,
are you going to talk about tollers or are you going to talk about the methodology?
About, yeah, I'm talking about the differential pricing and targeting.
Okay.
So given the short time that I have here, I'd like to focus primarily on this issue of the average, simple averaging versus a weighted averaging of the pool variance, because really this was the most complicated, at least for me, to conceptualize.
Well, it's a very simple issue, right? You're going to have two things, two pools, and you're going to either average them by saying a number from here, a number from here, add them, divide by two, or you're going to weight them, right?
Correct.
By saying, well, there are only two items in the first pool and there are 1,000 items in the second pool.
Right.
So you need to, trivially, mathematically, weight them.
Correct.
So what does the Cohen's D test that Commerce adopted say about that?
Okay, so I think you have to look at what is the comparison we're really trying to make with this Cohen's D test and figure out what does simple averaging.
So one thing is what Commerce said.
Sure.
Is there, and I spent a little while trying to figure this out and track this back to what Xanthan Gum, where this seemed to have gotten started in 2013 or 2014, and I don't see a specific reference. We adopt Cohen's D from the following source, and then that I was hoping there would, and then that source would say. But I looked at the Cohen's D book, and that's not actually so clear of when you have different pool sizes, which how you do the averaging, weighted or not. So I don't see we adopt the following, which tells me it's weighted averaging or simple averaging. So, but now Commerce here says, and it has about three or four sentences, here are our reasons for doing simple averaging. Can you address those?
Well, first let me address the fact that Cohen's D does not necessarily say which one you have to do.
I've seen both versions.
Okay, you've seen both versions. So when you're looking at what they did do here, you have to look at, does it accomplish the comparison that they're trying to actually make? And what they're trying to do here is figure out, okay, do the means between these two groups, group A and group B, the test group and the base group. I'm looking at the means first, and I'm taking a difference between those two means. And now I am trying to compare, well, does the difference between these two groups, the price difference between the means, is it in line with the price differences that are occurring throughout the group? And I think that when you look at the example that we provided on page 45 of our direct brief and our reply brief, you can see that if you don't weight the average and you don't take into account sample size and how big the different groups are, you have an inaccurate picture of what is going on in that group.
It seems to me that your numerical example certainly shows that you can get quite different answers according to whether you do simple averaging or weighted averaging. What is the argument for why, as between those two different ways of doing it, in your view, only one is permissible?
Sure.
Why is it inaccurate, or another way of saying it, inconsistent with the policy that this implementation of statutory provision is supposed to be?
Right. So I think if we could look back at the example, because I think that's where you really see what's happening.
Which page do you want?
So it's page 45 of the direct brief.
Of the
direct brief or reply, or it's on page 21 of the reply. So
21 of the reply.
Sorry, didn't make
you. I got it.
Okay. So if you look at this example, you can see that there is a price, or there is a difference between the means of 0.25 between the test group and the base group. And the test group accounts for 1% of the total sales of this condom, and the base group accounts for 99% of the sales of this condom, okay? So before I even do the pooled variance, if I just look at this price difference of 0.25 and I look at the base group, which has a standard deviation of 0.4, which means that 2/3 of the prices within that condom or within that group are within 40 cents of the mean of that group. If I look at the 0.25 difference, I can see, well, that looks like it's going to be not significant. It looks like it is in line with 99% of the price variations that are probably going on in this condo. And when you take the weighted average, if you take the pooled variance calculated by the weighted average, which ends up being 0.398, you can see, yes, this 0.25 is not significant, and it is consistent with what is going on in this condom. It is consistent with the pricing behavior of this condom. But when you take weight out of it, now we're just simple averaging these two standard deviations, and you have a pooled variance of 0.28, this price difference of 0.25, which was clearly within the range of 99% of the sales of this condom, now suddenly is a significant price difference. And you can, from that, I can see, to me, that looks completely inaccurate because it is not capturing what is actually happening within this condom. And Commerce has an obligation to calculate the dumping margins as accurately as possible. And that extends throughout its calculations, including Cohn's D. And if Commerce is trying to figure out, are the prices in this group, this test group, are they significantly different than the prices that are going on in the rest of the condom? If I'm not taking weight into account, I'm disassociating weight from price, which has a big impact on price, I'm getting an inaccurate picture of the prices in that condom. And that is ends up sometimes, like in this example, triggering significant differences where in reality, when you look at it objectively, that price difference is well within the range of price variations within that condom. So I see that I'm already into my...
I think that's one sure. The prices in several places in your brief and maybe some of the other briefs, you say, you know, some number, 48 cents or $48 or something, per what? Are these all
kilogram?
Per kilogram.
Yes. Everything's per kilogram.
Yeah, it wasn't stated in the brief.
Okay, I apologize. Yeah, it's...
Okay, thank you. And you've saved some rebuttal.
Okay, thanks.
Mr. Marshak, is there anything you need to tell us at the moment?
Your Honor, this what I'd like to talk about what Mr. Gordon said, was talking about at the beginning. What happened here is the government has...
I think you need to talk into the microphone so that we can recall what you have.
I apologize. The issue came up what Mr. Gordon was talking about in the morning when we began. The government has 15 minutes to reply to these two arguments, and the government, as it does in many, many cases, gave the party that was on its side ceded 5 minutes of time for me to talk about affiliation.
All right. Let me ask you, is there anything you need to tell us on the appeal in chief?
On our argument?
The Toler issue.
On the Toler issue?
Whatever it is that you're here for.
I'm here to...
I think Ms. Cote had something she wanted to add before we actually allow Mr. Marshak to address the merits.
Okay.
I would really, if Ms. Cote says everything, I have nothing to say. Ms. Cote leaves something out, I have something to say.
All right, we'll hear from Ms. Cotter.
This has been highly unusual. We were advised by the court that each side would get 15 minutes.
Let's just discuss the merits.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. we respectfully request that the court affirm the Court of International Trade's decision sustaining Commerce's final determinations, both for affiliation and for its differential pricing methodology. I'll begin with affiliation. Mid-Continent points to certain record evidence that it believes demonstrates control or the ability to control and or reliance. Commerce made a determination based upon substantial record evidence.
Well, let me separate what I think are actually two points that were made. One is insufficient evidence for Commerce to find no affiliation. But the other is completely putting aside sufficiency of the evidence, Commerce applied the wrong legal standard. So it simply didn't make the legally correct finding of inability to control. Can you at least maybe start with the legal aspect?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Commerce utilized the proper standard, just as the Court of International Trade did. When determining ability to control, the indicia for making that determination is identical to the indicia that one uses to make a determination about control. As Mid-Continent argued, one is prospective and one is present. So ability to control is prospective, but we start with determining, ascertaining whether or not there's any actual control going on between protein and its tollers. Commerce made both determinations, that underlying there is no current control and there is no ability to control, which is the potential that the statute and the regulations and the SSA speak to. The ability to control, the potential to control are the same. And the issues and decisions memoranda is replete with references to the ability to control. So too is the trial court's decision here. So,
and then turning to the evidence,
sure.
What is the evidence for finding insufficient ability or no ability to control, notwithstanding some of the facts that you know, show a kind of closeness of some of these?
Sure. Yes, Your Honor. The record demonstrated that there were at least 136 producers or exporters of nails in Taiwan.
These were would be the buyers from these companies.
These would be the buyers or companies that the tollers would supply to, yes. That eliminates any allegation of dependence on protein, because these tollers could seek to sell their services elsewhere to 136 other Taiwanese nail producers. Commerce explained that any appearance of closeness between protein and its unaffiliated tollers is the result also of the decentralized model or business model that ProTeam had. Commerce found that there were no contracts or agreements between these unaffiliated tollers and ProTeam. Commerce, again...
I'm sorry, no contracts?
No contracts or agreements.
Were they selling to them?
But there were no
contract.
Without contracts locking them into any future
term.
Correct. Yes, Your Honor. To determine whether a close supplier relationship exists, Commerce examines whether a company may exercise control over another company, such as the tollers here, protein and the tollers here, or may become reliant upon the controlling company, which would be ProTeam here. The evaluation of actual control is as much the same as the evaluation of prospective or potential to control. Both evaluate, as I stated earlier, the exclusivity of business activities, absence of competitors with whom the allegedly controlled tollers could do business, and a host of contractual agreements that prevent the allegedly controlled company from conducting business outside of the parameters of its relationship with ProTeam. So here, Commerce made a determination that there was nothing that confined these tollers to working solely with and for the benefit of and to be controlled by ProTeam.
Can I ask you to switch to the other appeal? Is that on the differential pricing analysis?
Yes.
Can you, the issue that I came into the argument most interested in is exactly the one that we heard about, which is the calculation of the pooled standard deviation by simple averaging as opposed to weighted averaging, which on its face is, raises some questions. Can you talk about what exactly Commerce's rationale for that is and why it is sufficient to produce a result as facially odd as this numerical hypothetical that's at page 21 of the gray brief, and it's in the one of the two red briefs also.
Yes, Your Honor. Commerce uses a simple average to ensure that the pricing behavior of the two groups, the test group and the comparison group, are weighted equally. To use a weighted average would skew.
Right, but also it seems this is, I guess, part of what I'm feeling frustrated about. To say that Commerce does it to weight them equally seems to me simply to use different words to describe what they're doing, not to justify what they're doing. And to use the word skew doesn't tell me what it is that skewing means. Why is in the relevant, for the purposes for which Cohen's D is being used to implement the statutory provision, is it sensible to give equal weight to a two-unit group and a thousand-unit or 100-unit group, I guess?
Yes, it is, Your Honor, when you're not analyzing or measuring the pricing within the groups themselves, but comparing the two groups equally. So these, there are only two groups to compare here, the test group and the comparison group.
Which is all the rest, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. That's correct, Your Honor. And by measuring with a simple average, it equally reflects the respondent's pricing behavior for the two groups. So it is the pricing behavior and not the prices themselves that are relevant at this stage of the Cohen's D analysis. And so what that means is if you used a weighted average here, you would it would result in inappropriately moving the pricing behavior towards whichever group had the larger number within it.
Can I ask you, I don't remember, I think maybe PT's brief said this. If it makes three different challenges to the methodology, but just focusing on this one, if PT were right about this challenge, would that, how would, do we know, how would that affect the ultimate determination of an anti-dumping duty margin here? Does that eliminate it? Does it put them under the de minimis level? Or does that still leave some cognizable more than de minimis anti-dumping duty?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. What I will say is that the statute doesn't specify.
Well, I think this argument is not a statutory argument. I think this argument is all this is just unreasonable. The other statutory arguments, which we didn't hear about this morning, perhaps because APEX makes them very difficult, but this is not a statutory argument. This is just you have not shown why this is Commerce. Commerce has not explained why this is actually a reasonable way to proceed, given the relevant statutory policies. And the explanation is just on, 24, 58, and 59, that those two pages of the joint appendix for this, I think.
I don't have it out. Well, what I was going to say is that it is within Commerce's discretion to determine how to identify significant price differences. And we believe that the use of the simple average is reasonable. Using a weighted average may also be reasonable, Your Honor, but that doesn't detract from the reasonableness of using a simple average. Commerce, again, uses the simple average to ensure that the pricing behavior, the pricing practices of the test and compare comparison groups are weighted equally. And this is consistent with what and how it uses the differential pricing methodology as it was done in APEX, as well as in several other cases that were decided by the Court of International Trade, affirming, sustaining Commerce's use of the practice, as well as the simple average. I believe my time is up. Thank you, Your Honor. And for all these reasons, we respectfully request that the court affirm the trial court's decision and sustain Commerce's final determinations. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Cotter. All right, for rebuttal, how have you organized it? Mr. Gordon, are you next?
I believe, yes, Your Honor.
May it please the court. We'll take up all of our time, I don't think. With respect to the close supplier affiliation issue, it is our position that the record supports one and only one reasonable outcome here, based on the substantial record evidence that these tollers should be found to be in a close supplier relationship with PT. It is clear on the record that the Commerce Department applied an incorrect legal standard demanding actual control and essentially a captive producer, not merely a close supplier. Similarly, the lower court affirmed using an incorrect legal standard. Moreover, the government's analysis in the underlying investigation was made on a collective basis. There's no evidence in the record providing any type of an individualized assessment of whether these tollers on their own are individually in a close supplier relationship. And ultimately, the very substantial record evidence, in our opinion, supports a determination that these tollers are in a close supplier relationship, requiring reversal by this court. So for these reasons, we respectfully request that the court overturn Commerce's determination and remand with instructions to find these tollers in close supplier relationships. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Schultz, you saved you 1 minute.
I have 1 minute, yep. So I want to answer, Your Honors, first your question about does the...
How big a difference it makes?
Yeah, so it makes it de minimis.
What?
It makes it de minimis if they use weight average.
Did you say that in your brief?
Yes.
I think, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
We did. I don't know the page offhand, but we said it. So I think what the government kept arguing is about that where we want to the pricing practices to be weighted equally. And the question that I kept asking in response to that was, why are we weighting them equally? We know what the weight is of each group. We know that in our example, you have 99% of the sales of this condom are occurring within this base group. Why am I not taking that into account if I'm trying to accurately determine whether the price difference between the base group and the test group is in line with the pricing practice overall in that group, in that condom. So for example, if you're taking the first quarter, am I over? I think I'm over. Sorry, I can stop there unless you have any questions.
Okay.
Thank you.
I think we have that issue.
Thanks.
Now, Mr. Marshak, is it your turn or is it over? I'm still not sure what
Your Honor,
these numbers
my
mean.
Time was going to come from the government's time. If the government went 15 minutes, I have no time. If the government has time left over to talk about the affiliation, I have that time. So it's okay. I have no idea if I have time or not.
Okay. Thank you.
Do I have time?
Yes.
Okay. I want to talk about affiliation. Petitioner, Mr. Gordon, is saying that it can only be one reasonable result. We believe he's just asking the court to reweigh the evidence. First, on the legal standard, we believe that the Department of Commerce and the court below used the correct legal standard. They looked for potential to control. You see that in their opinion. You look at the factors that they look at. One of the factors they look at, could you go someplace else to any one of the 136?
Didn't Ms. Cotet run through all of this? Do you have
I probably don't have anything new. It would just be an addition because I think the government did a very good job on this case.
Okay. I think we have that issue.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all. Your case is taken under submission.